If you're visiting with us this morning, we've been working our way through the book of Daniel on Sunday mornings. We started this study, I guess, about 12 or 13 weeks ago. And this morning we're going to get into chapter 10 and a little bit of chapter 11. And that might be a kind of an ambitious goal for us to have, because chapter 11 is the longest chapter in the book of Daniel. But I think it's going to be a good study. And before we do that, I wanted to review a little bit some of the material we covered last week, because last week was one of those classes where I was cringing a little bit as I thought back on it and reviewed how much material we tried to rush through. And also because sometimes when we're studying something that is interpreted different ways by different Christians and different groups of people, I tend to have a habit of maybe focusing a little too much on what I don't think it means, and that transfers over to you, and not spending enough time on what I do think it means. So I wanted to briefly summarize that and go through it really quickly and maybe spend a little more time on, you know, summarizing the 70 weeks prophecy that we studied last week in Daniel chapter 9. I walked you through a couple of interpretations of those 70 weeks, what those time periods actually look like if you start to count the 70 weeks from a certain date on the calendar. These are... Oh, it's not up there yet. Hey, Jeff, would you mind kicking me on there? I appreciate it. What's that?
It was on a minute ago.
Was it? Really? Yeah. Did my cable... It's cables. All right, so this is the slide that I showed you last week, and we looked at these three different starting points for the 70 weeks. Who remembers what Daniel 9 tells us the 70 weeks are going to start with? There was an event that kicks it off. Who remembers what that was?
Rebuilding.
Sure, the rebuilding of Jerusalem. So there's these three different methods that you can use to try to count it out to a point that aligns with some part of Jesus' ministry and life on earth, which is the end point for those 70 weeks, as we read in chapter 9. And we talked about how there's some difficulties with these different time periods. In the first case, it starts with what seems to be the exact edict from the king at the time to rebuild Jerusalem, but you end up at an ending date that's way after the life of Christ. In the second case... way before the life of Christ. In the second case, we end up kind of after the life of Jesus, but the starting point isn't exactly the same as saying we're returning to rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple. It was specifically focused on rebuilding the wall. And then I talked about this last method, which tends to be very popular today. It's a modern view, I would say, amongst Christians of various denominations. And the reason is because it lands well with the life of Jesus. The problem is Ezra wasn't really told to return and rebuild anything. So it's kind of a shaky, all of them are really kind of shaky in one way or another. And then from there, I went into this ultra-technical, ultra-precise attempt at counting these 70 weeks. You've got to adjust for, you know, the actual calendar year of the earth going around the sun. Adjust the Jewish calendar year, the Jewish tradition. You try to mash all that together. You end up being able to account for an extra 25 days at the end of it. Again, I'm not fully comfortable with that yet. If you are, that's fine. Again, I'm still studying this for myself. But I have a problem with some of these attempts to count these 70 weeks as exactly and literally as possible. Because in my view, when God wants us to know something precisely and accurately and exactly, we do. We can, right? We get there. We open the Bible. We use our minds and our intellects that God gave us to understand the word that he decided to communicate to us with that method, and we arrive at the correct conclusion. And it's difficult to arrive at a conclusion here that fits our need for this to be an exact period of time. And so that's a very... brief summary of what was already too brief of a class last week, covering some of that. So what about the 70 weeks? Where I ended last class was a quick synopsis here. And I think that we can just focus on what we know and let that be sufficient, right? We can focus on what we know and take the same kind of strength and courage and hope that Daniel would have taken from this. What we know is that this time period of the 70 weeks runs from the command to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah. We know that because that's what was told to Daniel, and that's what Daniel related back to us. We know that trying to count those years literally is sometimes problematic. And from our perspective, studying this thousands of years later, all of these events have already happened, right? The command to return and rebuild Jerusalem has already taken place. We believe that Jesus came to the earth and lived and died. We believe that that already took place. But from Daniel's perspective, this prophecy would have given him hope. Hope in a hopeless time, as we said last week. So, you know, I've become comfortable and content with the meanings that I see these numbers carrying elsewhere in Scripture. Seven is a number of completeness. It's a number of perfection. And elsewhere in Scripture where you see seven used, it's a predetermined number of times that something was to be done, or a predetermined period of time that God had allotted for something to happen and then to come to an end. 10 often represents superiority. It's the most of something sometimes. You know, think about the beasts that we studied, the heads, the diadems. These beasts were all-powerful in their realm. They were all capable. They were the mightiest or the strongest or the most of something. You put these two numbers together, you know, we've got a complete set of 10 in the number 70. Or another way to look at it is we've got the fullness of perfection, the fullness of the number 7. And then we have the 70 weeks. So at this point in my study and my growth as a student of the book of Daniel, I'll just tell you all that I'm comfortable leaving it at that. And I think that all of us would probably benefit from studying it even deeper. There could be an equation out there that I haven't seen yet that solves the 70 weeks, you know, just like that, and it all falls into place. But the ones that I have seen tend to be the more popular ones out there. The attempts that have been made over the years to try to solve that tend to cause problems on one end or the other. So that is where I'm at with the 70 weeks. That it's a figurative but complete and predetermined period of time that God allotted for these things to take place. And so that brings us to chapter 10. This morning I'd like to read chapter 10 and part of chapter 11. We have about 3 classes left in our study of Daniel. And so it's kind of the home stretch in a way. But these last 3 chapters are really kind of about the same vision. We're going to study the final vision of Daniel in these last 3 chapters. So I thought we could maybe start with a roadmap for how these chapters are organized. Chapter 10 is sort of like a prelude to the vision. We're going to read in just a moment the effect that this vision had upon Daniel. And we're going to see yet another aspect of Daniel's prayer life, which is a theme that's popped up over and over and over again throughout this study. In chapter 11, we're going to see Daniel's account of this vision. It's very, very detailed. This might be, you could say, the most detail-rich vision that Daniel shares with the reader. And if you remember way, way back when we started studying, we talked about one of the main objections to the book of Daniel by critics, and that's that it's just way too accurate to really be prophecy, which is a great problem to have, right? If that's the main objective to your book, that it's just way too accurate. It can't be prophecy. If you start by ruling out the possibility that there's a God who has created everything and that he desires for his people and his believers to know some things about how he works in this physical realm and what kind of power he has. If you start by just ruling that out, then yeah, we've got a problem with Daniel because it's really, really accurate. On the other hand, it can be a faith-building aspect of the study, right? And so chapter 11 is one of the reasons why that objection exists. And you're going to see in just a few moments when we get into chapter 11, it's incredibly detailed. I mean, I would put it in the same category as the suffering servant passage in Isaiah. It's so accurate. It hits the bullseye so well with what we know about historic events that it's very humbling and amazing. So that's going to be chapter 11. Chapter 12 concludes this vision. It concludes the book. And we see some final instructions given to Daniel by his visitor and this messenger that comes and delivers these things to him. And I would say that in all the book of Daniel, for me anyway, some of the most inspiring and encouraging language is in chapter 12. It ends on a high note. There's all this destruction. There are all these symbols, all this apocalyptic writing. There's all this tumult. But Daniel 12 has a happy ending. It has a very positive message for the original readers and for us, and I'm looking forward to getting to that. Okay, let's go ahead and talk about some of the background details in these chapters. If you look at chapter 10, verse 1, it says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia." And then if you glance at chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Darius the Mede." trying to figure out which Darius and which Cyrus we're talking about back then is kind of like trying to determine, you know, which John or Tom or Bob today we're talking about. You know, that these are fairly common names. And I actually had a lot of trouble with this part of this study because there are some who would say that these are the same ruler. It's thought by many that the Cyrus king of Persia in chapter 1 and the Darius mentioned in chapter 11 are actually the same guy. I haven't really found that to be conclusive in my studies, but there are a lot of conclusions that have been drawn about who's who, what order these kings ruled in, what the actual succession was of the kings of Syria and the kings of the Medes and the kings of Persia. My take on this is that the Darius in chapter 11 is probably the same ruler that we see named in chapters 5, 6, and 9, right? Do you all remember where Darius pops up onto the scene? He shows up just at the end of a chapter. It was at the end of chapter 5. Belshazzar meets his end. And Darius the Mede takes over. I think we're talking about the same king here. I also think that if you read at the end of chapter 6, it kind of implies that these are separate people. Chapter 6, verse 28. "So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." The way that's written doesn't strike me as it's talking about the same guy with two different names. I could be splitting hairs, but my take is that Cyrus probably rules after Darius, if you look at the succession of the kings that are in power throughout Daniel's life. And if that's true, then chapter 11, Daniel is kind of going backwards and he's saying, this is the vision that I received. So the vision in chapter 11 may chronologically fit before chapter 10, but I'm not pedantic or 100% firm on that. That's just kind of the way the facts fall out for me as I've studied this. So chapter 10, like I said, is sort of a prelude to the vision. Daniel lets us know when that vision takes place later on in chapter 11. Chapter 10 is going to contain some details that are really challenging for me. We're going to get a perspective on spiritual forces and spiritual battles and how the characters in those conflicts play out in the physical world. And then chapter 11 contains the main body of this vision, like I said, and some have said that even the divisions of these chapters, the way that these scriptures are organized, is a little bit awkward, maybe a little bit non-intuitive, that maybe the chapter divisions might be better off shifted to other places. You can draw your own conclusion on that as we read it, maybe reordered. You know, everybody has their own opinion about those things. I just offer it to you to try to make the study a little richer and a little more meaningful as we get into it. So let's go ahead and read the first 9 verses or so of chapter 10. "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar, and the message was true and one of great conflict. But he understood the message and had an understanding of the vision. In those days I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. I did not eat any tasty food, nor did meat or wine enter my mouth, nor did I use any ointment at all until the entire 3 weeks were completed. On the 24th day of the first month, while I was by the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face had the appearance of lightning, his eyes were like flaming torches, his arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a tumult. Now I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision. Nevertheless, a great dread fell on them, and they ran away to hide themselves. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me. For my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. But I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. Okay, so this message is revealed to Daniel. We don't know what the message is yet, but we know that some message has been given to him, and that it's had a terrifying effect on Daniel. To me, it seems that he is fasting and praying earnestly because of the message. It doesn't say that word for word here, but at this point, as I'm reading this passage, I'm sort of asking myself whether he's praying and fasting because he's looking for understanding that he doesn't have yet, or whether he's praying and fasting because he already understands this vision that we haven't been told about, and it terrifies him. And he's praying and fasting out of a reaction to that. It's not really clear to me which one it is yet. I think it becomes more clear as we get into chapter 11 which one it is. But the visitor seems to be an angel, right? Is this the first time Daniel's been visited by an angel? Okay. Have you ever wondered how you would react if you were visited by an angel? Maybe I'm the only one that wonders things like that.
Scared.
Scared? Yeah. This is Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego playing a prank on him later in life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dwayne? You may not know that it's an angel. Yeah, I guess I what you're saying, though, is if he came to talk to you, if he came for the purpose to give you, there'd be some understanding there, for sure. What I think is interesting is that this is not Daniel's first experience with an angel, and he's still having the same reaction. And that's what I take from that is that's exactly what happens to a person when they are confronted with somebody from the heavenly realm. It doesn't matter if this is your first angel visitation or your third or fourth, like in Daniel's case, this is the effect that it has. Yeah, Dwayne.
Why did the crowd fall back when they went to take Christ in the garden? Apparently, just the force of his person caused them to fall back. I do not know of any other explanation for it.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to me that Daniel's companions don't see this visitor. What does that remind you of? Sure, the vision on the road to Damascus. So it's intended for Daniel, not Daniel and company, not these other guys. It's intended for Daniel. Okay, let's keep reading. I'll continue in verse 10. I'm going to go ahead and finish out the chapter. Then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees and said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I am about to tell you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the king of Persia. Now I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. When he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And behold, one who resembled a human being was touching my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke and said to him who was standing before me, O my Lord, as a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me, and I have retained no strength. For how can such a servant of my Lord talk with such as my Lord? As for me, there remains just now no strength in me, nor has any breath been left in me. Then this one with human appearance touched me again and strengthened me. He said, O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. Take courage and be courageous. Now as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength and said, May my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, Do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia, so I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces, except Michael, your prince. Okay, crystal clear. I really think this is more challenging. This last section here is more challenging for me personally than a lot of the other passages we've studied, even some of what we've looked at in Revelation. Because I don't have too many other passages that I can turn to for parallels where something like this takes place. But I want to focus on one thing first. From the first day that Daniel began praying, that's what it says, there was already an answer. God heard him from the first day. But the answer came 3 weeks later. So, what does that tell you about the Father? What's that?
Persevere.
Okay, that persevere when we're waiting on an answer.
And wait. Apparently, all the period of 3 weeks, Daniel's demeanor did not change.
Mm-hmm.
Kept on with his piety, mm-hmm. and his subjection and reverence. Undiminished.
Yeah, and I think it's clear from verse 12 that it seems like the reason he was praying and fasting was because he wanted the understanding. Previously, that isn't really clear, but it seems like that's why Daniel was committing himself to prayer and fasting, is he wanted to understand. He wanted to have the meaning that comes along with these terrifying messages that he receives. I think it's neat that the messenger bothers to tell him, from the first day you started asking, there was an answer. That you were heard the first time you asked. You've been waiting, but you were heard. And an answer was dispatched to Daniel. So what are you praying about these days? I mean, what are you praying for that hasn't been answered yet? Think about what kinds of supplications and requests are finding their way into your prayer life these days. Think about whether or not you've gotten an answer to those things yet. And take comfort in the fact that God probably heard you on the first try, but he's got a different schedule sometimes than we do. Sometimes part of the answer, I think, is in the waiting. There may be things that God has in store for us while we're waiting on that answer to come that are part of the answer itself. I've been praying a lot lately, you know, for my kids to stay healthy, for me to stay healthy. Those are things that I just want to keep going indefinitely, right? I'm not waiting on a specific answer. That answer comes every day when everybody's healthy. Praying for my parents, been praying for all of us. Been praying for this congregation and for our leaders and for the work that we can do in this area. Sometimes we can pray for opportunities, or we can pray for a job change, or whatever it is. But I take a lot of strength and comfort from the knowledge that a man who was God's faithful witness to the people of God in Babylon while they were in captivity, a man who received multiple visions from the Father, and was God's chosen messenger on many levels, that man that we've been studying for 14 weeks waited 3 weeks sometimes to get an answer. And so if we wait 3 weeks or 3 months or 3 years, we're no worse off than Daniel, right? We have every right to be. I have every right to be worse off than Daniel. I haven't lived anywhere near the same kind of life that he has. But I think the same God that heard Daniel's request the first time he made it and answered it 3 weeks later is the same God that's hearing your requests. It's the same God that wants to know what your requests are. It's just another aspect of this man's prayer life that's amazing and humbling to me. Dwayne?
I think it's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so now we have to get into the part, you know, that's harder. Yeah. Well, let's consider these other princes. So we've got this messenger that tells Daniel he's got to return to fight against the prince of Persia. And it was some sort of issue with that prince that delayed him these 21 days. Okay? We know that the prince of Greece is coming, and towards the end of the chapter, the very last thing this messenger says is that, other than Michael, the prince of your people, I'm alone in this conflict. What in the world does that mean? All right. Shoot. Yeah.
Well, I don't know of any other places in Scripture that talk about this situation. But Ephesians chapter 6 talks about this. When we're told to put on the whole armor of God,
yep,
we're not told to do so that we can fight against men.
Right.
I mean, specifically, verse 12 of chapter 6, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So I think the first thing that you can either be encouraged or discouraged by is to know that while the angels apparently are fighting a battle we can't see, we are given armor to put on and fight in the battle with them. That perhaps the angel here is fighting alone or just with Michael. No one else is putting on armor and suited up in the battle. But now we are given armor to take part in this battle with the angels. We don't understand exactly what it is, but they aren't alone anymore because we're God's people and we are part of that army.
And we have spiritual armor that's for spiritual warfare, right? Yeah. Well, you know, to me it sounds like each of these nations has a champion in the spiritual realm. That's kind of how it sounds at first. It almost sounds like God's people, too, have this guardian angel in Michael and in this visitor. And I picture these spiritual champions, these generals almost, in the spiritual realm, warring with each other. And there's this conflict going on a higher plane that's almost invisible to us, except for the way it manifests itself in the physical world. Barry?
Just to add to what Adam said, what you're saying, Jesus gives us a little bit of insight. He quotes a passage in John 10, 34, 35. The Pharisees are taking him to task, saying he's God, he's the Son of God. And he quotes from Psalm 82, where it said, I say, you're God's. He said, call from God's. Second, if you go back to Psalm 82, it's a really short psalm. Psalm 82 describes a time in which God gathered a divine council of spirit beings and took them to task for not delivering the word of God, of course, as Jesus later says he does. So it's real short. I'll read it. Psalm 82.
Well, if you want, I can read it up here at the mic. Yeah, and then I'll turn it back over to you for a second. So Psalm 82, God takes his stand in his own congregation. He judges in the midst of the rulers. How long will you judge unjustly and show partially to the wicked? Vindicate the weak and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and destitute. Rescue the weak and needy. Deliver them out of the hand of the wicked. They do not know, nor do they understand. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods. All of you are sons of the Most High. Nevertheless, you will die like men and fall like any one of the princes. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for it is you who possess all the nations. That's Psalm 82.
So, in the ESV, it actually begins with, he gathers his place in the divine council.
Divine council, own congregation, yeah.
Right, so I'm just emphasizing this is a...
It's a staff meeting.
It's kind of similar to what you see in Job chapter 1.
Yeah.
All the angels together and stuff like this. But it's just interesting that Jesus comments.
Yeah.
And they failed the task.
Yeah.
The angels brought the work of the law through Moses.
Right.
The angels did all that. So just tying that together is, you know, you get a little people view of something that you
really yeah.
And
I wish we had more than a peephole, but I'll tell you, at my point in this study, I think that this has helped me, and I hope it's helped you, to find some comfort in that place where we don't really know the whole story. Because it used to really bother me. It used to make me want to close my Bible and go, this is frustrating. That's more my personality than anything else, talking there. But it excites me to think about what these things could possibly mean. Yeah, Charlie? Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point, Adam.
I think your point about hopefully we're to a situation in Daniel with ourselves that we can do with this what he was supposed to, which was to be encouraged by it. We could be discouraged, as you said, that we don't understand it all. Or we could be encouraged that God gave us enough to understand that he's fighting a battle for us that we can't see.
Yeah.
And maybe the reason that we only get a peephole is because we can't handle more than that. There's a whole lot going on that's above our pay grade. And trying to understand more than what we're given here may be more discouraging than encouraging. And this was meant to encourage him.
Yeah, it absolutely was meant to encourage Daniel. And as you all have been talking, and especially that passage in Psalm 82, I appreciate very much you bringing that up. One thing that popped into my head a second ago was if there have been angelic powers that have been entrusted with God's word and botched it, what does that say about Daniel that this visitor is coming to him and calling him out right at the start, man of high esteem? I'm here to tell you what this means. That just kind of gives me chills. I didn't think that that chapter 10 would actually fill up this time period, but it just about has. I want to leave you with a couple of other thoughts. We might start chapter 11 in just a minute. I think it's difficult for us to really comprehend this. It's difficult for us to imagine what these spiritual forces and these spiritual conflicts really consist of. Would everybody agree with that? It's difficult. I wonder if these present and future conflicts, from Daniel's perspective, right? These are present conflicts and they're future to him. To us, they're past for the most part. But I wonder if they are just as real in the heavenly places as they are about to be on the earth. What I mean is, I don't know if these analogies are going to be worth anything to illustrate the point, but If you've ever been working in your yard and, you know, you're fiddling with an extension cord, when I finish mowing my lawn, I blow my driveway off with a blower. And I haven't broke down and bought a gas-powered one yet, so I'm still fiddling around with this 100-foot-long extension cord. And it gets wrapped around stuff because I had to install landscaping lighting, right? So I have this pole sticking out of my flower bed, and it likes to get wrapped around that. It likes to get wrapped around rocks and stuff. But I've gotten kind of good at giving the cord a flick, and it just unloops itself, you know, and I keep on going. And my son saw me do that one day, and he was just blown away by this wave that traveled down the extension cord, popped itself off of the rock, and then I kept on going. And so we had a little science lesson there, and I was telling him, you know, that's energy. That's energy, buddy. It traveled through that cord. I mean, all I did was pump my arm, and I shot energy into that cord, and it moved, and that's all that was. And then we talked about the beach. Have you ever been at the beach and stood and just kind of wondered what is driving all these waves that keep coming? I mean, they just keep on coming, right? Have you ever been to the beach where there weren't any waves? The waves are just coming, and they keep coming, and they keep coming. And so we talked about that, too, for a few minutes. And, yeah, I'm getting a little nerdy here, but seriously, it's kind of fascinating to me that what you're seeing when you see a huge wave come into the beach from the ocean, the water's moving. Yeah, the water's moving. But that's not what you're witnessing. What you're witnessing is energy, and it's moving the water as it travels. And the reason why the wave looks the way it does is because the form of that energy is a waveform. It's a sine wave. And the water is manifesting that energy for you in the physical world. And the energy is in the physical world too. Just like the energy that I pumped into that cord when I shook it off the rock, right? But I can't see that energy. I can't see it. It's like when I aim a telescope at a distant star or a planet, that image that comes back to me is something that I can interact with. It's something that I can witness. But the energy itself, it's a frequency that's traveling through the fabric, literally the fabric of our universe. And I get to witness it because God created my eyes so that they are sensitive to those waves. And they create pictures for my mind when the waves hit them. But that doesn't mean that I can see the source of that energy. And it doesn't mean that I can see what's actually causing that to happen. The best I can do is look at the shape of the water. Look at what that extension cord did. Look at the picture that I see. I kind of wonder if some of these wars that are about to take place after Daniel's life, are the world moving as these conflicts and these spiritual powers move through it? I kind of wonder if what we're seeing and reading about here is the physical manifestation of these spiritual conflicts that we can't see. I can't see that spiritual battle really any more than I can see, you know, energy moving through the solar system. But I can see the picture that it leaves behind. I can't see the energy that the solar system is injecting into the ocean, but I can see what the ocean does because of it. And I may not be able to see Michael. I may not be able to see Gabriel or the Prince of Persia or these super powerful angelic beings that are in positions of authority, positions of military leadership over some of these powers. I may not ever be able to see those things. But Daniel was given a glimpse into what the consequences and the results of those things were going to be in the physical world. I don't know if that's helpful to you. It's maybe a half-baked idea, but that's the similarity that I see between the two things. Granted, on one hand, I'm talking about a wave in the ocean, and on the other hand, we're talking about spiritual powers. But the fact that we can't see the source of it, and we can see the manifestation of it in our realm, in our physical realm, I think is kind of similar, and it helps me to be content, I guess, to be content with what I do know and what I don't know, because it's really no different than a lot of other things that we try to understand about the world that God created around us. Adam.
First of all, today, I think that was a fantastic illustration. But the other thing is, I like what you've done in this class of bringing Revelation in every now and then. And this feels like a perfect time for a bird revelation. So I don't know if you plan to, but I will.
Go for it.
Hope that's okay.
Yeah.
If you boil the book of Revelation down, there's a whole bunch of like events that are really concerning and really scary and problematic for God's people. Until you understand that the entire point of the book is that even though there are times that are scary, the point is that God wins. God is in control. He can slay the dragon. He can do all those things that we need done, even if we don't understand all of them.
Yeah.
And what we can take hope and solace in is that these things are going on in the heavenly places. And while there are angels that are powerful, there are princes and authorities and all kinds of stuff that are fighting, apparently, the book of Hebrews tells us that there's one really, really important person who's also in the heavenly places taking care of us.
Yeah.
And that's Jesus. So despite who's there fighting with each other, none of them are as strong as Jesus is. None of them are as powerful as he is. And none of them are interceding with the Father for us like he is. And so it should just be really, really encouraging to know that God wins. And he does so through the power of his Son. And that's the power that holds the universe together. And that power is fighting for us. It's not fighting for some random evil thing. It's fighting
Yeah, to sum that up, we have the best champion of all,
yes.
Right? And all of all these spiritual champions and these spiritual powers we've been talking about, ours wins, right? Yeah. 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 Yeah, and isn't it amazing that the prayer of this humble servant of God was enough for God to repurpose one of those spiritual champions from what he was busy doing to go talk to Daniel for a minute? Thank you for making that point. At the end of this chapter, we end with a tone of resolution for Daniel, right? He feels better. But do you guys feel better? I want to know what this vision was all about. I want to know what on earth he was told. So we're going to get into that next week. We'll start chapter 11 next week. Excuse me. Thank you so much for your comments and questions. You've enriched this lesson for me this morning, and I appreciate that, and I hope it's been beneficial for everyone.